Sorry, I gotta set myself up here. Is my mic on? Said it was on, but is this on? Okay. Okay. Yeah. Or I plug in down there. Thanks. Good morning. I'm impressed there's so many people here at 8:30 on a Saturday morning. For me, it's 6:30 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. It's sort of like the Oxford Don when he was asked to speak to teach a class at 9 a.m. He said, "Nobody should stay up that late." I'm always so relieved when the AV actually works. The audiovisual demons are the last lingering demons of the modern world, have you noticed? So I want to begin actually by showing you a little film clip. If I can find it here. Sorry, the connection with the projector has altered everything on my screen. Well, it looks like I'm not going to find this. That's too bad. There we go. All right.
This is my husband. He voted against federal funding for sex dolls.
Is he a doctor?
Is he a scientist?
Why did Thomas ensure that my mom is in the sex?
Help me.
Help me. Maybe I don't know.
Maybe I regret it.
Maybe I feel a little bit. Maybe I don't know.
Sex doll research can save lives. Maybe yours or your family. Someone you love. And the kind of insurer said no.
How come you think you get inside the way you're not? What do you
mean? But doing research is responsible for the kind of thing that.
So, that was just 5 years ago at the national election. Doesn't it seem like a long way away? It's lots has changed in this front. The financial meltdown, two foreign wars, and now the looming crisis over whether or not we're going to raise the debt ceiling. Somehow the whole controversy over embryonic stem cell research seems, at least for the moment, less urgent. At most, it seems to be simmering on the back burner. For one thing, the hype has given way to the long and arduous task of delivering on the promised cures. And I think it's fair to say that there's some measure of disappointment, at least acknowledgement how difficult this will all be. Embryonic stem cells are unstable, lines are variable, there are genetic and epigenetic problems, and it's proving difficult to differentiate embryonic stem cells into some functional cell types, such as beta cells, which are promised for curing diabetes. It is true that the FDA, by the way, I thought this was especially ironic, it's a political advocacy site. We fight because lives can't wait. Well, there are lives involved in this controversy on two sides of it. We have advanced the point where there are two FDA-approved preliminary trials. Advanced Cell Technologies announced that 12 patients with Stargardt's muscular dystrophy, which causes vision loss in children after the age of 10, will be enrolled in combined Phase 1, Phase 2 safety and efficacy clinical trials. And Geron Corporation, right there in Menlo Park next to Stanford University, is using embryonic stem cell-derived oligodendrocyte progenitor cells to try to treat spinal cord repair. These are very preliminary trials, and even here, some scientists have cautioned against pushing too hard prematurely into potentially dangerous human trials in the face of continuing pressure from overly eager patient advocacy groups. Not only this, not only is everything going slowly, but there are advances in adult stem cells that seem more immediate, if not more promising. So at first glance, one might say, well, the political temperature has been turned down by the change in administration, that with the new administration, science has been lifted above the fray. Indeed, President Obama, in promulgating his new executive order that overturned the Bush policies and made more cell lines available for federal funding, proclaimed a new, more enlightened approach than the previous administration. Henceforth, he promised he would see to it that, quote, scientific data is never distorted or concealed to serve a political agenda, and that we make scientific decisions based on facts, not ideology. Those are the words of President Obama. But it looks like basing scientific decisions on facts, not ideology, is not as straightforward as the president assumed. My colleague at Stanford, Irving Weissman, researcher, physician, and at the time president of the International Society for Stem Cell Research, welcomed the change in policy, but he decried the fact that it stopped short of approving SCNT, that's embryo cloning. This is a quote. The policy banning funding of other stem cell lines produced by transferring the genetic material from a patient to an egg is a terrible disappointment. It seems inconsistent with the president's promise to allow scientific facts to determine science policy. So it's not so easy. And he was not the only one who was disappointed. During the comment period before finalizing the guidelines for the new Obama policy, the NIH got 49,000 comments, mostly against the principles of the policy. Stem cell biologist Teresa Deischer says, "I was very disappointed. I had hoped and thought that they would listen." She goes on, "It's very difficult to get passionately, morally protective of what physically truly is a clump of cells. But that is a human being. Scientifically, you cannot debate that." Deischer, who's been called the Sarah Palin of stem cells, was joined by stem cell biologist James Shirley in a direct challenge to the Obama policy on the argument that it violates the Dickey Amendment. The Dickey Amendment was passed in 1996 and has prevailed. It's been renewed every year. And it basically says that human embryos will not be created and destroyed or knowingly subject to risk of injury or death in the process of federally funded research. This argument, by the way, is all about federal funding of research. On the state, local level, it's controlled by those jurisdictions, and people are free to do what they want to with their private funds for the most part. Interestingly, Judge Royce Lambeth, a federal judge in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia, ruled with the plaintiff and against the Obama policy. He imposed a temporary injunction, which was then appealed, which was stayed, and then about 2 months ago was sent back down, was overturned, because the higher court panel felt that they didn't have a strong case. Just on Thursday this week, Judge Lambeth basically withdrew his ruling and dismissed the case, not because he didn't think there was merit, but because he thought that the higher panel of the court, basically said that the law was so ambiguously written that it could not the plaintiff would not prevail. The interesting thing here was that what his ruling hinged on was he believed that it isn't adequate, as the NIH counsel had said, that if the stem cells are obtained and the embryos killed with private funds, the federal funds can be used to study the cells. In other words, they disjoined the two dimensions of this. And he thought that that was not legitimate, but apparently the higher court thought it was, or the panel thought it was. That's, by the way, the principles of complicity. If you go to Hong Kong and get an organ for transplant, and you say, "Well, I don't know where it came from, and it's not my business," it might cause you some moral qualms to consider it might have come from the execution of a political prisoner somewhere in a prison in China. Nonetheless, this is a principle that's operating now in our government. Embryonic stem cells can be obtained by the destruction of an embryo with private funds and are then eligible for federal funding at taxpayer expense. But interestingly, the European Court, just a few months ago, ruled that this connection was, in fact, relevant. They vacated all patents on embryonic stem cells, maintaining that one cannot patent the product derived from the destruction of a human embryo. So controversy continues. The interesting thing is that now, just in the last 2 weeks, legislation has been reintroduced at the federal level by DeGette. It used to be called Castle DeGette, but Castle was voted out partly for his stem cell positions. DeGette now has put forward legislation that will allow the funding not just of leftover IVF embryos, but also the specific creation of embryonic embryos with sources for embryonic stem cells using cloning, if that technology, which so far hasn't succeeded, can be made to succeed. So, after more than a decade of debate, discord, and political maneuvering, the controversy over embryonic stem cell research continues. it's still a serious matter in search of a sound resolution. What is needed is a comprehensive policy grounded in coherent moral principles and solid science that will open a way forward with consensus. But given the current political climate, we may instead be heading for continuing controversy. I think the GET bill was reintroduced just in time so that it will be an issue in the 2012 elections, strategically so. So why is this so urgent? Because what is at stake is so central to both the future of our biomedical science and the character of our civilization. If we step back and place all this in a wider perspective, we can better understand the source and the significance of this controversy. We're at a crucial moment in the process of scientific discovery. The dramatic advances in molecular biology throughout the 20th century culminated in the sequencing of the human genome and increasing knowledge of cell physiology and cytology. These studies were accomplished by breaking down organic systems into their component parts, studying them as biochemical processes in the test tube. Now, however, as we move from genomics to proteomics to discoveries in developmental biology, we have returned to the study of whole living beings. When applied to human biology, this inquiry reopens the most fundamental questions concerning the relationship between the material form and the moral meaning of developing life. The current conflict over embryonic stem cell research is just the first in a series of difficult controversies that will require us to define with clarity and precision the moral boundaries we are seeking to defend. Human-animal chimeras, such as the use of animal eggs for nuclear transfer to produce human-animal embryos, human-animal hybrids, parthenogenesis, the activation of an unfertilized egg, and projects involving laboratory production of tissues and perhaps organs, these in a wide range of emerging technologies will continue to challenge our definition of human life. Now, clearly, these are not questions just for science alone, but for the full breadth of human wisdom and experience. The scientific arguments for going forward with this research are, I think, strong. And I should say I'm a physician, and I know very well the needs that they are targeted toward, and we should take that all very seriously. The convergence of these advancing technologies is delivering unprecedented powers for research into the most basic questions concerning human development. Beyond the obvious benefit of understanding the biological factors in the estimated 150,000 cases of congenital birth defects every year in the United States, 8 million worldwide, beyond that, it's becoming increasingly evident that certain pathologies that are manifest only later in life have their influenced or maybe indeed caused by factors in their early development. So this kind of study is important and has valuable promise in it. Furthermore, fundamental developmental processes, including the formation and functioning of stem cells and their disordered dynamics, seem to be at work in a range of adult pathologies, such as perhaps cancer. Yet from a moral perspective, there are serious concerns. However much we may have promise of therapies, of scientific knowledge, there are serious matters in this debate. This is an 8-cell embryo on the sharp tip of a pin. That's how small we're talking about is. But I would remind you, small is not a measure of moral worth. It's important to acknowledge the many scientific projects for which human embryos could be used. Beyond their destruction for the procurement of embryonic stem cells, some fear the industrial-scale production of living human embryos for a wide range of research in natural development, toxicology, and drug studies. Lord Alton, a member of the House of Lords in the United Kingdom, told me 6 years ago that they had already used 100,000 human embryos in scientific experimentation in the United Kingdom. Beyond those concerns, there's concern about the commodification and commercialization of eggs and embryos, and worry about the implications of ongoing research to develop an artificial endometrium, a kind of artificial womb that would allow the extracorporeal gestation of cloned embryos to later stages for the production of more advanced cells, tissues, and organs. Furthermore, from a social and political perspective, in the current controversy, there's an emerging patchwork of policies, red states and blue states, and there's controversy between nations. This situation threatens to create a condition in which there will be commercial motivations for outsourcing ethically controversial illegal research. Sending it off to where it can be done without moral controversy. You can imagine where that might be. Likewise, there will be medical tourism by patients in desperate quests for cures. In countries like Australia, where embryonic stem cell research, including cloning, is legal but still controversial, large numbers of patients may someday enter the hospital with moral qualms about the research foundations on which their treatments have been developed. What was traditionally the sanctuary of compassionate care at the most vulnerable and sensitive moments of human life is becoming an arena of controversy and conflict. Moreover, we all know that public support for biomedical research is crucial, and without consensus, it'll just be another source of conflict in Washington. Yet at stake is an issue that is, in my mind, the central challenge of our age. It's our generation's special moment in the unfolding drama of civilized society. Indeed, it's a special moment for our species and for the whole sense of our place within the phenomenon of life. For the first time in the entire history of living nature, we now have the power to comprehend and control the biomechanisms of our very being. For the first time in history, we can create and sustain human embryos apart from their natural place of protection and nurture within the womb. It was just 100 years ago we could even keep a cell alive apart from the body. Now we can create and sustain the organism apart from its natural womb. The central moral issue of our age, I believe, is the status of the human embryo. Whether we consider it a biomedical resource to be used instrumentally in the quest for cures, or we consider it the early stages of a human life. That's the issue. Political and financial crises will come and go, but we are at a hinge of history. How we decide this issue will determine both the future of our biomedical science and the very character of our civilization. And by that I mean globally. Not just within America. So we need to stop and ponder, what does this mean? What hinge is this? Where might it lead us if we choose one path over another? I want to proceed through a series of questions and reflections and then conclude with a few comments from a more personal perspective. And what I'm going to tell you about is not... It's somewhat extreme. I've chosen dramatic things, but it's all published either in leading journals or in interviews. It's all either existing research or research predicted by top-level scientists in the near term. So, is it only embryonic stem cell research that's urgent enough to justify an exception to our long-standing federal policy against funding for the destruction of human embryos? Or will we now endorse the use of human embryos for a wide range of studies of infertility, for example, or early development? The first point is that, let's be very clear about it, embryonic stem cell research is just the poster child for the whole era of developmental biology. Wouldn't we want to, from a scientific and medical perspective, wouldn't we want to know how the embryo is knit together, every phase of form and function? Beyond the pure fascination of deeper self-understanding, such an inquiry would create the scientific foundations for a fantastic future in medicine. And anyway, as it's said, the embryos are going to die, so why not use them for a full range of studies? Why, if his embryo is going to die, We would just harvest the stem cells at 4 to 5 days. Why wouldn't we want to study them longer or do more things to them? Wouldn't we want to study, use them for a range of studies like toxicology, refinement of the culture medium used in vitro fertilization so we can perfect that? Because it's well known that there are concerns about the medium in which some of our fellow humans have been cultured at an early stage. Wouldn't we want to study early cell migration and differentiation, the epigenetic factors, and the role of maternal environment on early development? And might we want to create special embryos for study of certain factors, for example, in this case, genetically modified embryos, to study what specific genes are doing in the process of early development? And wouldn't we want to create chimeras, human-animal creations, so we can study just specifically what happens with human cells and perhaps produce animals that will be a source of disease models or even a source of tissues and organs? This is the geep, by the way, a chimera produced by joining the early cells of a sheep and a goat. So, of course, if we create these things in a laboratory and don't just use existing IVF embryos, that raises the question, will we allow the creation of embryos specifically for research? The current policy does not allow that, but it was left open for when it becomes relevant. So what would we create if we could? Knock-ins, knockouts, study the role of individual genes. Would anybody want to do this? The New York Times, at the moment that President Obama changed his stem cell policy, the New York Times, reflecting the views in the scientific community, wrote in their editorial saying that the president had not gone far enough. New York Times wrote, other important embryonic research is still being hobbled by the so-called Dickey Wicker Amendment. Until that changes, scientists who want to create embryos and extract stem cells matched to patients with specific diseases will have to rely on private or state support. Such research is one promising way to learn how the disease develops and devise best treatments. And then they say Congress should follow Mr. Obama's lead and lift this prohibition, in other words, get rid of Dickey Wicker, so that important work can benefit from the infusion of federal dollars. The International Society for Stem Cell Research agrees. I was at this meeting. They joined forces with the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine, which is the $3 billion stem cell project in California, and in a 2010 joint report stated, in conclusion, this workshop highlighted the important roles for human SCNT, that's cloning, in research, understanding nuclear reprogram, and in therapeutic development. Overcoming the barriers to cloning is probably achievable and continues to be an important gap in our quest for improved knowledge of human development and regenerative medicine. And I think we can all see where this might go. Cloning could offer a unique research tool by allowing standardized batches of genetically identical embryos, allowing selective genetic alterations and comparison studies. Likewise, laboratory-generated identical embryos would allow accurate assessments of the effects of environmental pollutants or toxicology studies of drug effects on early development. So who's going to do this? Well, we all know the promise of all this, and worldwide it's caught the attention of people. This was a stamp in honor of Woo-Sok Wang, you remember that guy who said he'd done it in Korea? Of course, that proved to be fraud. But scientists are busy in Australia, at Columbia University in New York, by the way, with the support of the New York State Stem Cell Institute, which provides funds to pay women to undergo superovulation to obtain an abundant source of oocytes. That's, of course, the weak link in this project, getting the eggs. But the New York State is now funding the procurement of eggs. It was a project that wasn't doing so well. Women were very reluctant to do it. Harvard put $100,000 into seeking egg donors and didn't get a single one. But when the recession came, apparently there were enough people in desperate financial need that they stepped forward to be super ovulated. And by the way, returning to Wusok Wang, did you know that he turned up in Libya just 3 months ago? And apparently he was working there, and maybe Gaddafi wanted to be cloned. Anyway, it's out there. People are still working on all this. So that raises a strange question. If we do get eggs, and if we do develop this cloning technology, or even if we don't, eggs are useful for normal fertilization, and as everybody knows, there's abundance of the other gamete. How many embryos is it okay to use in research? The availability of eggs is the bottleneck. It's expensive. It's somewhat dangerous. There's a certain level of serious negative effects, including, by the way, a certain number of deaths from superovulation. And women are reluctant to do it, but there were probably other ways to get eggs. So how many embryos would we create if we could get eggs? Well, it looks as though there are going to be ways to get eggs through in vitro culture of cortical tissues. And if that's the case, then there will be many more eggs, and there are even projects to develop eggs from embryonic stem cells. You know, remember the whole point of embryonic stem cells was that they could produce all the cells and tissues of the body. Well, eggs are one of those. In fact, embryonic stem cells may come from the lineage of eggs themselves. So in an interview with Nature magazine, stem cell biologist Davo Salter, the Institute of Medical Biology in Singapore, speaking of directly differentiating pluripotent stem cells such as embryonic stem cells or the new induced pluripotent stem cells, differentiating them to eggs. This is what Davo Salter said. And I know this guy, Davo Salter. He's a nice guy to talk with. He's a little radical, but here's what he says. You could have millions of gametes that could be combined at will, assuming you could get an abundance of eggs. Today, you can't experiment on human embryos because it's considered morally repugnant and they are difficult to get. If embryos could be grown in culture like any other cell line, this latter problem would disappear. They'd become like any other type of cell line. They would become objects and would be used as objects. He continues, I have no idea what kind of moral value or rights we would give to these embryos. We'll probably go through the same agonizing we did with IVF. It could be terrible to begin with, but then it'll become a fact of life. Another ironic phrase, a fact of life. Maybe 20, 30 years from now, we'll read in the newspaper that someone made 20,000 embryos and studied their development and we'll decide, oh, it's okay. People will get tired of this controversy and one side or the other will win just for sheer exhaustion. So that brings us to the fourth question or concern. Will we allow research on embryos beyond the stage where embryonic stem cells can be harvested? Such projects allowing research on embryos beyond 14 days could provide valuable scientific information and possibly allow for the production of more useful cells, tissues, and organs. Would anybody want to do this? Well, listen to this quote. This is from Mary Warnock, who was chair of the Warnock Commission, which set the 14-day limit in the United Kingdom in the mid-80s. I remember vividly, after the publication of the report on embryology and fertilization, taking part in a television program with Bob Edwards, who was responsible for IVF, Edwards and Steptoe. And in this interview, he said, what I would really like to do is to keep an embryo alive in the laboratory for more than 14 days, but I am a law-abiding man. I nearly killed him for saying that because we were facing a very hostile audience at the time, and I had envisioned saying that nobody would want to keep an embryo longer than 14 days. But he said he did want to, and he could not, because of the law. There may have been many other scientists who would have liked to conduct research on embryos older than 14 days, but as far as I know, nobody has. Why would they want to? Because they're very, very useful projects scientifically for this. Here's one. Derivation of epiblast stem cells, the next stage. And they argue that this would allow a better understanding of embryonic stem cells and their dynamics. And moreover, this is a very smart statement. Richard Young of the Hoyt Institute points out that when we culture cells outside a normal organism, they acquire features that may not be compatible with life once they go back into the organism. We don't have the control of the microenvironment and the subtleties in the spatiotemporal dynamics of development that the embryo does. The embryo is the ideal place for producing cells, tissues, and organs. But it's a living human being. Already, products of abortions have been used to obtain fetal stem cells. And fetal stem cells have been used on literally hundreds of scientific and clinical trials. Here's one on treating strokes. Here's another repairing livers. And here's another where they made a beating heart in the laboratory in a breakthrough that could allow doctors one day to make a range of organs for transplant almost from scratch. What they did was they took a fetal heart, they digested out the living tissues, used the scaffolding and sewed it with progenitor cells, which then multiplied, grew back, and eventually linked together to form a new organ. You can see where all this is going. It's absolutely amazing. In many ways, it's fantastic science, if it weren't for the fact that there's a fundamental moral issue here. But for many, that doesn't matter. Here's an Oxford physician and biomedical ethicist. He says it may be that research using early human embryos is ethically preferable to research in animals, since it would not cause the research subject to suffer, and research findings are more likely directly transferable to humans. And here's a view from India. And by the way, we should be very attentive to the international perspectives on this. As we are quite used to using animals for scientific research, where's the harm in extending that to the use of human life, especially human life at a primordial stage? Now, you might say, well, that's a different cultural view, but within our own culture, there are a whole range of views. And these views are driven subtly by human longings, human desires, jumping back to what uses have been made with fetal or later stage cells harvested from abortions. This work was done in subhuman mammals, but could be theoretically applied to humans. I read a study in which they took the suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is the part of the brain that controls the circadian rhythms. They took that little segment out of the brains of fetal hamsters and put them into aging adult hamsters, and the ones that got the transplant were kind of tuned up. Their rhythms were more solidified. You know how old people are constantly going to sleep? I don't see anybody out there sleeping, but old people go to sleep at inappropriate times. Their circadian rhythms are unbalanced, but somehow this reset the clock, and those hamsters that got that, according to this study, lived 30% longer than their cohort. How about that? Now that's a motivation for science. But what does it mean, and who would do it? Well, here's a statement by Hank Greeley, my colleague at Stanford, nice guy, I like him. He was chair of the California State Commission on Human Cloning, and I was at this conference where he was asked, it was a neuroscience conference, and he asked, why did you guys stop at 14 days? Why did you say that should be the limit? He responded, that could be changed in the future based on understandings that would likely come from neuroscience. Think about what that means. What's he saying? Well, this is what he's saying. This is by another colleague at Stanford, Ern Le Young, who started the Center for Biomedical Ethics. He says, when asked about the status of the embryo and whether he could use it for obtaining parts, he said, the blastocyst or embryo, that's this 4 to 5 day embryo, the blastocyst or embryo is a human organism, but not a person, therefore has no moral standing. It does not even become a potential person until the emergence of a rudimentary central nervous system, something that is thought to happen at about 26 weeks of gestation, others believe as early as 18 weeks, by the way. Therefore, and he quotes another bioethicist, Glennon, as he puts it, since embryos do not have the requisite biological structures to generate and sustain the mental capacities, embryos cannot be benefited or harmed. Do you see the implication of that? That embryos aren't really moral beings until, according to him, 26 weeks. And increasingly, the debate is shifting from 4 days, 5 days, 14 days to consciousness, whatever that is. We've got to be careful. Got to be careful where this is going. You might say, well, who would support these ideas? Who would be so extreme? Well, listen to this. This is just a few quotes. Here's a Princeton professor. In my view, fetuses that die before they're ever conscious really are a lot like plants. They're living things, but there's nothing about them that would make us think that they count morally in the way people do. And internationally again, ancient Confucian idea, a person is only truly considered to be a human after birth. South Korean court ruled that the unborn child will not be considered human until the mother goes into labor. And would there be uses for this? Or is this just theoretical? No, there would be a fantastic array of uses. Indeed, if there were not moral issues, this would be the accelerator would be the floor on this project. There are quite a range of studies that suggest that we could obtain useful cells, tissues, and organs from aborted fetuses, or maybe specifically gestated fetuses, strategically and very carefully harvested for just such projects. Oxford University stem cell expert Richard Gardner, a very respected scientist, asks why fetal tissues are not currently being harvested from abortions because they show the promise of being useful as organ transplants. One of his colleagues says, yeah, that would require later term abortions, but that's okay. He said, many babies are aborted quite late, and if they're going to be terminated, it's a shame to waste their organs. Why is this so important? Why is this something we should be concerned about? Why is this realistic? Well, maybe it isn't. Maybe there's equipoise in the moral conflict that'll suppress this kind of project, but maybe not. The scientific reasons are very apparent. It's because within the context of the embryo, development takes place in a subtle spatiotemporal environment. Stem cells, in this case, an adult stem cell in pink, are surrounded by other cells, which send specific signals in a complex pattern, spatiotemporal dynamics, that both renew the cell and send out a developed, more differentiated cell. And this is the way the embryo unfolds, so these complex signals in a context not just of chemical signaling, but actual physical forces, including pressures and adhesions and so forth. So it's not going to be easy to duplicate in the dish. And this is how the individual organs are formed in this context. Consider, for example, the limb, the human forearm and hand. Not exactly an organ, it's quite the normal traditional sense of transplantation, but maybe it would be transplanting faces, and actually hands have been transplanted. So here's how the hand forms. It starts as a little bud off of the shaft of the embryo, and then slowly this little limb primordium, which starts at about 4 to 5 days and almost microscopic, and it grows upwards and extends itself. And amazingly, if you cut this off of an aborted fetus, it will actually grow and give it a supportive environment. It will actually continue to grow apart from the embryo. Once the information is placed in it, it will continue to grow. And I have seen just such a little hand. I was walking through a biotech company in Palo Alto 21 years ago, ancient history in biotechnology, so you can imagine what's been done since. So I was walking through, and down in a test tube, a friend of mine who worked there held up a test tube, and he said, look in there. And down in that test tube was a little tiny hand, 3/8 of an inch across. And I looked at it, it was perfectly formed. And I said, where did you get that? He said, well, we snipped off the primordial limb bud from an early embryo, put it into the abdominal cavity of a skid mouse designed not to reject it, immune rejection, and let it grow. It induced blood vessels, wired in, was nourished. We sacrificed the mouse 3 weeks later, and there in the abdominal space of the mouse was this perfect little hand. And I looked at the little hand and I thought, wow, this is fantastic. This means we could perhaps one day grow hands for people who had had accidents or injuries or congenital defects. And then I thought of a little hand thought of my own children, the little hand that lies across mommy's breast and she's nursing. And what a beautiful scene that is. And I thought to myself, that little hand was somebody's hand. And now it's in a test tube. The embryo is dead. Serious, serious issues. What could we do with this? Well, Oxford physician, bioethicist. I debated this guy, Julian Savulescu. I debated him in New York a couple of years ago. Another really nice guy. But here's what he says. The best way to do this would be to clone embryos. Now, it may not be possible to do it, but if you could, he says it's morally required that we employ cloning to produce embryos or fetuses for the sake of providing cells, tissues, or even organs for therapy, followed by abortion of the embryo or fetus. In other words, you're creating an embryo just to harvest its parts. But why not if it isn't a human until 26 weeks, right? Would this work? There's quite a lot of evidence it would. Moreover, it's clear now that there are certain stages where you would have to go to get the optimal organs. Before it's too early, later there's immune rejection, whatever. It would be all very technological and very controlled. Quite a few people have written on the value of this. They've established that miniature kidneys from kidney primordia can actually produce dilute urine, and we could probably perfect this. Here's an article from 2003. Israeli scientists said on Monday that they had successfully grown human kidneys in mice. This was taking kidney primordia, just as the little hand was done. Kidney primordia, put in mouse abdomen, and then letting it develop. From 8 to 10 week old aborted fetuses, that's where these came from. And they tout this as a breakthrough that might one day help save thousands of patients waiting for transplants. On the President's Council, we studied transplantation. There are 60 or 70,000 Americans waiting for kidneys. 17 a day on average die. There will be huge commercial pressure if this can be done technologically. And I would be surprised if it isn't being worked on quietly in labs offshore, maybe even in our country. Chinese doctors actually nurtured a human heart for 13 days after taking it out of an aborted fetus. Moreover, this guy, self-styled bioethicist and author Jacob Appel, who writes for the Huffington Post, he maintains that this would be just another extension of the natural right to choose that a woman has. And he suggests that there be a market for fetal organs. This would empower women to use their reproductive capacities to their own economic advantages. If a woman has the fundamental right to terminate a pregnancy, why not the right to use the products of that terminated pregnancy as she sees fit? Many women would likely use the proceeds of such sales to finance college education or to help raise their children. What's he talking about? Choice need not end with the removal of the fetus. And then he goes on to say, someday, if we're fortunate, scientific research might make possible farms of artificial wombs breeding fetuses for their organs, or even the miracle of men raising fetuses in their abdomens. Scientists 20 years ago showed that it's possible to gestate a mouse embryo in the abdominal cavity of a male mouse, at least part of the way through gestation, probably long enough to get organ primordia. I don't think that's going to become a big problem, men carrying babies, no. But still, it shows you how flexible developmental biology actually is. I mean, these are extreme statements, people getting attention, and but the science is bubbling along under the surface. Dr. Sheng Liu, I talked with her about all this. She and her team have grown tissue samples from cultured endometrial cells removed from human donors. They then fashion an artificial womb in the shape of a uterus, and they implanted embryos into it. They found that the embryos correctly implanted into the artificial uterus lining and started to grow, and she managed to gestate a mouse 2/3 of the way through its gestation in this artificial environment. This work dates back several decades. When I was a med student in the early 70s at Stanford, a researcher was studying embryos that had been aborted very early embryos, trying to keep them alive. Well, there's a researcher in Japan that has a device where he can take a fetal sheep out of its mother's womb and sustain it for some period of time in a floating in a sort of pseudo-amniotic fluid. There are efforts. I don't see why this would be impossible. It would be very challenging. But another possibility is to open up the abdomen, pull out a segment of the omentum, which is a big fatty sheath that covers our abdominal space, and just directly implant an embryo into that. The embryo will grow in any vascular tissue. That's why we can have abdominal pregnancies in the first place. I think this kind of thing could be done technically. Whether it will or not depends on our moral perspectives. There's the sheep in the artificial womb. So, here we are, an amazing moment in human history. Amazing possibilities rising, and the question is, what will we do? These projects are generally motivated by genuine scientific interest and therapeutic intent. I do not demonize my colleagues. But they're also driven by deep desperation. That's the inevitable shadow of the realities of human mortality, frailty, infinitude, disease, and death. Perhaps more dangerous are the agendas of those who seek to employ these powers beyond therapy in the quest for ambitions and appetites. And we're all subject to this. We all have to fight against it. Already there are a range of possibilities for stem cell-based plastic and cosmetic procedures, including breast augmentation. But more realistically, we all know there's a huge pressure to use biotechnology now in two ways. One is for the personal ambitions, pleasure, and images of appearance and so forth. In fact, even for what's been called by the postmodernists free play, a kind of indulgence in the aesthetics of the self and the body, getting the most pleasure and attractiveness out of your body you can through technology. And then, of course, the other side of that, the flip side of that, is competition. Uses of stem cells to enhance powers to give you an advantage. An advantage, you know, like steroids, only steroids on steroids, if you will. All this will truly be corrosive to social solidarity and spiritual community. And then, of course, looming in the distance in the background is that larger agenda of the post-humanists for post-humans, trans-humans, and techno-sapiens. Where are we heading? As we gain powers of comprehension and control over our most basic biology, there's a transformation not just in our physical being, but in our whole sense of who we are and our place and purpose within the order of nature. If this is seeds of possibility, and for most balanced perspective, it's the beginning of this process where this is the same person across all stages of life. This is the tradition in which we have lived. But now there are projects beyond that. They're leading us not just to changes in our technology, but changes in our self-concept. As we take increasingly instrumental control over natural life processes, our attitudes change, and we lose a sense of cautionary reverence and respect. With each step, however benevolent the initial intentions, there is moral danger, a fracturing of matter and meaning that breaks the coherence and natural connections of life. With each step, the original radiance and vitality of the cosmos, its order, beauty, and coherent moral meaning are obscured by the conviction that all of living nature is mere matter and information to be reshuffled and reassigned for projects of the human will. This instrumental use of human life reaches its most ominous extension as we relegate the human embryo to the status of a resource, a raw material in the service of our project in the mastery of nature. Such an instrumental use of early human life opens a doorway to a long corridor, indeed. We need to stop. We need to think. As the quote said, when you start down a path, the beginnings, you have to sense where the destination will lead us. We need a coherent understanding. We need to recognize that from the initiation of fertilization, we have a living human embryo with the imminent powers for its own self-development, self-maintenance, self-integration. In biology, the whole precedes and produces the parts. That is a living human being. It's a self-sustaining, self-subsisting being. There is every reason to suggest that the moral worth we endow and give to one another should be extended to the earliest stages of human life. And I believe this is consistent with Christian history. The earliest Christian document we have after the New Testament is the Didache, which specifically prohibited abortion. I think such a position, honoring the embryo from the earliest moments, is consistent with our faith and our community across time and culture. We'll all be tempted by these things because we all, we're natural creatures, we care about flourishing and fullness of life. We're drawn to images of perfection. In fact, these images are inflamed by our commercial culture. But will we forget? Will we forget the real calling of our lives, the deeper engagement with life that involves addressing suffering, not just with technology, but with love? What an amazing world we have. It's a poignant and complex world. It's a world in which we sense both the beauty of the original creation, and we know we should not erase it, its messages, its meanings, its symbolic sense, displace it with concrete buildings. Yet we also know that technology will lift us beyond some of the great tragedies and troubles, struggles of human life. Those are very real too. Question is, how do we seek perfection? Jesus told us, be ye perfect, but that was perfect in love, not perfect in body performance. Human life is a mystery. We start out as tiniest beginnings, and we unfold in this progressive development, both physical form, comprehension. Blaise Pascal noted that human existence is located between infinities. And he went on to say, by size the universe encompasses and swallows me up like a dot. By thought, I encompass the universe. Well, what kind of a thought could encompass the universe? And might that thought guide us at this moment in scientific and human history? Here's a quote from Julian of Norwich. And in this he showed me something smaller, no bigger than a hazelnut, lying in the palm of my hand, as it seemed to me, and it was as round as a ball. I looked at it with the eye of my understanding and thought, what can this be? I was amazed that it could last, for I thought that because of its littleness, it would suddenly have fallen into nothing. And I was answered in my understanding, it lasts and always will because God loves it, and thus everything has being through the love of God. What kind of understanding could sustain us now in this difficult moment of social conflict, philosophical conflict? I would suggest that that thought is love. C.S. Lewis once said that we should answer all of our problems with more love, not less love. Thank you very much.